Okay, so today during the class, if you feel like, you know, if you're falling, if your sugar levels are falling down, please help yourself. Normally, I just have to yell at you not to sleep. So it is Deepavali in India. I guess a majority of the students here know what that is. The minority, you come along for the ride. It's a festival of lights, and you know, it's a pretty nice, fun time. Okay, so what we are going to be talking about is text classification. That's what is the topic for today. Before I go ahead, are there any questions? Okay. So how is the project 2 going? What? How many, I think it's due, when is it due?
Thursday.
So are all ready? How many are done with project 2? People who are not done should close their eyes so that people who have done can raise their hand so that they won't get killed afterwards. But I can take it until, I mean, it's Deepavali or not, okay. So we can take it until next Tuesday's class, okay. And there is one extra project left, and that takes pretty much one more month. And so we will give it to you by next Tuesday. And then it would be due by like December 1st, okay? Because the way it would be is that I think the TA has to have demonstrations of the project for all three parts from you. That's what he does normally. And so we need time for that. And then 6th is the end of the semester. And so, you know, you won't get any extension for that last part. You know, whatever I say is the deadline is the deadline, because there is no time. Okay, but since anyway we can do this, the project 2 can be submitted until Tuesday. Okay, I think Sushovan was going to send a note about the overall patterns and the trends in the project 1, part 1. If he hasn't already sent it, he will do it, you know, soon, like this today or tonight or something. So that, and also basically since I'm returning the project part 1 today, you know, in case you need to improve your writing of the report for the second part, you know, you could actually use this time. Okay. Any other questions? Anything else? Okay. So I am going to be talking about text classification, and essentially it's an easier problem. We already looked at clustering text documents into groups, okay, where you did not know how many groups were present to begin with, okay, and then we talked about techniques for doing that. Now, and it has obviously several, you know, clustering has several advantages, several applications. We talked about them. Now, a connected problem, a somewhat easier problem actually, is the classification, where essentially somebody told you labeled examples. So in a binary classification problem, that means you may be saying the following are the relevant documents. These are the examples of relevant documents, D1, D2, D5, D7. And here are the examples of the irrelevant documents for me, okay? D4, D20, D31. Okay, given these documents, then the question, so I already told you this. Remember, in clustering, essentially all I would have said is D1, D2, D5, D7, D4, D20, D31. And you somehow have to figure out that there is something common about this and something common about this. That's what you would have done in clustering. In classification, I'm telling you that you have actually two, in some sense, two groups. In this case, binary classification problem, you have two groups. Okay. If it's a multi-class classification problem, you might have multiple groups. Okay. So if you're coming from the clustering point of view, you might think that somebody already gave you a piece of data in which they identified the clusters. They said this part of the data is in this cluster, this part of the data is in this cluster, and some other part of the data in the third cluster, let's say. Okay. The question then is, so what's the problem then? The problem is, if I were to give you D19, which hopefully is not anywhere here, the question is which cluster is it supposed to go to? That's the classification problem. Okay? So it's an easier problem because I've already shown you the clusters to some extent. I've shown you the classes. We normally call these classes. So this is class 1 and this is class 2. And so these correspond to class 2, these correspond to class 1, and I gave you a new document, and you need to tell me whether it is in class 1 or class 2. And if it's a multi-class classification problem, tell me which class it belongs to. Okay? That's the classification problem. Tons of uses for this. Given examples of fraudulent and non-fraudulent credit card transactions, you want to predict whether a particular credit card transaction is fraudulent or not. That's like an outside of text documents, for example. Within text documents, given a bunch of mails, some are spam, some are non-spam, you want to be able to predict whether it's a non-spam mail or a spam mail. Okay. We'll give another slide with a whole bunch of other examples, applications of classification, but there are tons of them. One other one is recommendation system. So given that you liked the following articles and didn't like these other articles, here is an article, should I show it to you or not? That's a recommendation system. Okay. Now in fact, retrieval itself, the very problem of information retrieval can be seen as a classification problem. Right? Suppose the user, instead of just giving a query, shows, I like these documents, I don't like these documents. In some sense, they gave a query to you now. Okay? Your problem then, the only difference is in normal classification problems, I will have test data, and I'll give you, here is a document, is it relevant or not? Here's another document, is it relevant or not? If you're trying to use classification techniques in retrieval, then having seen the relevant documents and irrelevant documents, you need to retrieve relevant documents. Just don't show me relevant documents at all. Just retrieve all relevant documents. Here are some examples of ones I like. Here are examples of ones I don't like. From the huge corpus of documents I have, get me all the documents I would like. So in some sense, retrieval is a sort of an active classification problem. It's now, instead of waiting for somebody to give you a document and classify it, you're trying to bring in all the documents of a particular class. Okay, so that's the connection. And in fact, the very first technique we will talk about for classification has both a classification version and a retrieval version. That's the relevance feedback. Several of you actually have read that stuff in preparation for the exam, but I didn't discuss it in the class. Today is the first time I'm going to be discussing relevance feedback. So now, how does it differ from clustering? I hope you understood by now what is the difference. In the case of clustering, you don't know what the clusters are. You just have the data. Okay, and even when you come up with clusters, you don't know whether those clusters actually correspond to some natural classes or not. All of those problems are gone now. Somebody else, a teacher, told you these are relevant, these are irrelevant. Okay, and so labeling has been already done, and then you need to test, basically classify the test data, test documents, since we are looking at it from the, text data documents point of view. You want to classify the test documents into the correct classes. Okay? And how do you do it? That's basically a categorization problem. Now, suppose I were to come up with an algorithm for doing it, the question would be, how do I know if it's a good algorithm? And if I came up with an algorithm for classifying, and my friend came up with an algorithm for classifying, okay, both of us came up with an algorithm for classifying, let's say spam versus non-spam mails, for example, simple case. Okay? And the question is, how do I compare the algorithms? And in the clustering case, we talked about internal and external measures. Internal measures of intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance. External measures of RAND index and the other things. Forget now. Okay. So here, actually, what all you are actually looking for, the simplest case is on the test data, you need to classify correctly. Okay. If I give you, 1,000 documents as test documents, you haven't seen them before. You don't know what their labels are. Okay. I will give you one by one, and you'll say, yes, this is spam. Yes, this is not spam. No, this. Yes, this is spam. This is not spam. This is spam. This is not spam. So you came up with your classification. I know the true classification for the test data. So I'll compare my classification to yours and count all the errors. Okay, and that would be the error rate, basically. Now the question would be that, and the accuracy would be the fraction of the test data that you classified correctly. And a really, really good algorithm would have 100% accuracy on the test data. Now the other interesting thing, of course, is suppose there are two algorithms which have 100% accuracy on the test data, can you still compare them? Well, you can. It depends on, you know this from the midterm. A lot of you probably know a lot of the stuff. Some of you don't know, and so you didn't actually, even if I gave you more time, you wouldn't have completed the exam. Some of you knew the stuff, but you just did not complete it in time. Right? Anyway, so the question then is, it's not exactly that, but in this case, the issue is, how many examples did you need during the training phase to learn the concept? Okay, so the x-axis here is the size of the training set, not the test set, but the training set. So actually, forget about the midterm analogy, it's a bad analogy. What I really want you to think about is, some of you can just, hear the concept once and you understood it. Okay, some of you might have to go back, listen to the videos, throw away the whole thing and use a textbook and learn it, yourself. Some of you may have to do 3 or 4 homeworks and then, problems, and then you will learn the concept. Some of you, I hope none of you, would never learn the concept because there is, internal limitations in the CPU. Right? Okay. So now the question ultimately is, all of you are being evaluated in terms of as being learners. That's what ultimately what we are trying to do. In the tests and so on. Did you learn it? Okay. People who learn it for very few examples then can take a lot more courses. Okay. People who are slow learners will take fewer courses, spend more time, multiple examples, etc., until they get it. Okay. Either of them are fine, and then there are people who may never get it. Right? Okay. So the question is whether this kind of a view helps us compare those examples, and it turns out yes. These are called, by the way, so this curve here is called a learning curve. Okay, all this is doing is it's plotting as the number of training examples is increased. So think of this as, this basically means you just hear it in the class and you already got it. Okay, whether you got it or not, this basically means you took the test just after hearing the stuff in the class. Here means you spent some time reading it before taking the test. Here means you did more examples before taking the test. Okay, so the question then is, the test is hopefully, is being given in each case, and then I'm counting your accuracy of classification, and I'm plotting this. Okay, most normal learning curves would look like this. So your performance is not particularly good when you have very small training data, and as the training data size increases, your performance increases. Performance in the test data increases. Okay, as the training data size increases, the learning time is increasing. Okay, so that basically means, so I can actually, just as you have Christian recall curves, I can have nice pictures about learning curves. So here is the training data size. And here is accuracy. Okay, so I can draw all sorts of interesting curves. The very best curve basically, would be something like this. 100% accuracy. You know, like barely before I open my mouth, you already got it, and you stay there, right? And that, you know, so that's your like perfect precision recall curve kind of a thing, okay? And then mostly you would get, you know, let's say I have a curve like this. I have another curve, okay, this is one, and this is one, this is two. Which is better? Two is better because eventually it is reaching 100% accuracy, but it's reaching it faster, its learning rate is higher. Okay, so it needs fewer examples to learn to the same level of accuracy. Okay, how about this? Okay. There are learners like this too. Okay, so this is three, this is four. Which one is better? It depends on how much data you have. Okay, so you all think that there is something called a gold standard for exams. Obviously there isn't, right? So in this particular case, if the time for training is low, if the amount of training data is low, up until this level of training data, you think three is better than four. But three actually has CPU limitations. It never actually is raising above, you know, whatever, like 20% accuracy. But then this one is slowly, as the data is increased, it is reaching. You know, it's at least, you know, maybe it'll hopefully go to 100%. Yeah.
Supposing that you have two classification clusters, you should start by 50% accuracy.
Okay, that's a very good point too. Actually, I did not say here what the accuracy means. Okay, so in this particular case, if you have multi-class classification, if I have something like 20%, and I have a multi-class classification, that's very much possible, because if I have n classes, then if I'm randomly picking, I'll get 1 over n probability of being correct. Okay, if I have 1,000 classes, getting 20% accuracy is pretty darn good. Okay, however, if you have two classes and you're getting 20% accuracy, don't laugh, you are actually a good learner. This is like that Seinfeld quote where he says, if your every instinct that you have is wrong, then doing the opposite of your instinct will be right. Right? Right? So in fact, in binary classification problem, the worst learner is the one which has 50% performance, not the one which has 20% performance, because 20% performance can be put in a little box, and whatever it says, you just flip it and get it out, and that's going to be a good learner. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in fact, this idea that you should actually look at learning curves and you should look at whether or not the learner's performance is better than 50% in the case of binary classification is something that is obvious but wasn't obvious for researchers working in machine learning, you know, even like 20 years back. And so there were machine learning algorithms that were published, and if you were to implement it and you do opposite of what they say, you get better performance than what, you know, if you do what they say, because they never actually tested them. Okay? So anyway, so evaluation is important. That's why in the very first slide I'm talking about how would you evaluate. You know, that's what I did for clustering too. Okay? So anyway, so in this case, accuracy, you know, in this case, my assumption that if this is 20% and it's a bad learner, it must be because it's a multi-class classification problem, where you can get 20% accuracy and be very happy. That means 20% of the time you actually pick the correct class. Most of the other time you pick one of the wrong classes. Right? Okay. So anyway, in this case, 4 is a slow learner which actually asymptotically reaches full accuracy. Okay? Whereas this is a fast learner that sort of plateaus out. Okay, just as we talked about precision recall curves, which is a good system, and we could draw different precision recall curves and talk about which is a good system. You know, I know that this is the perfect one. You know, in fact, the perfect one just goes shoop like that. That's it. And you can't beat that because it basically requires zero data and it already knows the concept. Okay, but everything else, there are multiple ways of comparing them. The speed of learning, the amount of training knowledge you have, etc. Now, while we talk about, when we talked about clustering, I mentioned the fact that clustering is called unsupervised, but it's not completely unsupervised. You tend to have some information anyway about clusters. Okay, sometimes you might know how many clusters are supposed to be found. Sometimes you might know that certain data points cannot be in the same cluster, or they must be in the same cluster. All of this is partial knowledge, which makes clustering a little more into supervised side. Okay, so in classical machine learning parlance, you have unsupervised, and which is clustering, and then the other extreme is supervised, and which is classification. Right? Except, I said, clustering actually, in many real cases, becomes little less unsupervised, a little more supervised, because you tend to have some knowledge. And similarly, in most realistic scenarios, classification tends to become less supervised. Okay? One of the big things, and we won't talk about it in today's class, and if I feel like I might talk about it next class, is the biggest problem in applying learning techniques, you know, classification learning techniques, let's say on the documents on the web, let's say, is what? Is it that there are not enough documents? There are tons and tons and tons of documents. Okay, everybody has mail, and you can, you know, basically Gmail can just look at all their mail and say, some of them are, you know, spam, some of non-spam, but the documents are there. The hard part here is the labeling. Labeled data is not as easily available. Okay, you have a lot of data, but it's not all of it is labeled. So if I can somehow come up with classification techniques that can deal with, you know, some labeled data and the rest unlabeled data. Okay, that would be great. And I mentioned this, I believe, in the beginnings of the semester. Not only would you have worked out examples in a math book, they'll also have exercises for which you're guaranteed to have solutions, but you're not told what the solution is. And people who work on those examples still tend to do better in the exam. So that's the case where math book has both labeled examples, those are the worked out examples, and unlabeled examples. Students who only look at the labeled examples learn only at a certain level. Those who can also exploit the unlabeled examples can do much better. You see what I'm saying? And so, in fact, the interesting question in the classification is, can you write a learning algorithm that uses not just labeled data, but some of the unlabeled data? And there are techniques for doing that, and I might mention it later on. But if you do that, it becomes less supervised than extreme supervision. Okay, and if you do this, if you start adding more knowledge, then it becomes more supervised than unsupervised clustering. So all fun algorithms are somewhere in between. You know, it's like an example here would be semi-supervised learning. It's semi-supervised, and that means it's not fully unsupervised, it's not fully supervised. There's a whole bunch of techniques for that. But again, the first order of business for us is to at least understand the extreme. Classification and clustering before we start talking about the middle. Okay. By the way, in this case, so this is the learning error plot. This is the what's called the learning curve. If you have, let's say, a binary class problem, spam and non-spam problem, okay, and in general, actually here, all errors are considered equal. In drawing this, you're assuming all errors are considered equally bad. Okay, sometimes some errors are more problematic than other errors. So for example, you know, a doctor can randomly tell, yeah, you are suffering from this disease, and to everybody, or basically give antibiotics to everybody, thinking that they are suffering from all sorts of diseases. Okay, and they could be, they are obviously misclassifying the patient's disease. Right? If the patient actually has a viral fever, there's no point in giving antibiotics. Okay, that's one kind of error. The other kind of error is a doctor who doesn't want to give antibiotics unless they're completely sure, which sometimes might involve actually, you know, in the, during a postmortem, finding that you have bacteria in your body. Then you will try to give antibiotics. That doctor is making a different kind of error. Right? Now both of these doctors will be considered the same error in this case. You know, it'll add to the same, you know, one point to the error rate. Okay? But clearly these errors have very different consequences. In the US system, basically, you know, doctors if misdiagnosed, and you can go back and tell them you did not give me medicine, enough medicine, and so I had to kind of wake up in the middle of the night, then you can sue the doctor. And so doctors don't want to take that chance. So they're very worried about not giving you antibiotics. And so even before you go there, they'll give you antibiotics. I just found out today that apparently the only exception is the student health center, where they apparently you can't sue them. And so they do not give you antibiotics. They actually depend on postmortem, I think. But anyway, so I mean, I have a student in my lab who apparently had to suffer for like a full week before people had to carry him, and then they gave him antibiotics. Not, you know, it's not that bad. Anyway, so the point again, the whole point of this discussion is errors are not all created equal. Okay, you have different costs for different kinds of errors. And, you know, you learned based on the cost structure for your errors. You know, standard assumption is we assume that the cost structure is equal. All errors are equal. Okay. But, you know, cost-based learning, you would consider errors of omission might have a different cost from errors of commission. Okay, if you have a binary class measure, binary class problem, you know, you don't need actually people with, you know, diseases, right? I mean, even spam and non-spam, right? Which is bigger for you? You know, saying a mail from Rav saying that tomorrow there's going to be a pop quiz, and that says, oh, pop quiz looks like spam, you know, and you put it in the spam. That is one kind of an error versus another kind of an error where essentially you let a couple of Viagra messages come through, right? Because, you know, you did not catch up, right? So which one would you be more worried about? I think for most people, basically, they're more worried about missing real mail because they got misclassified as spam than occasionally letting through spam mails, right? So, and if you are writing a spam mail detection system, if you don't care about this, then you can essentially get into trouble, right? So, of course, we do have, if you have binary classifications such as spam and non-spam, we have vocabulary to talk about this. Precision and recall. Imagine all you really care about is non-spamness of the mail. Okay? Are you able to correctly predict that this mail is non-spam? If you did so, then you have high precision. So is every mail you are showing me really non-spam? If so, you have high precision. If are you not showing me some mails that are non-spam because you kind of, you know, threw them into the spam box, in which case you have low recall. Okay? So in that case, you would consider precision and recall, and so sometimes you will have learning curves drawn not with respect to accuracy, but with respect to F measure, which is essentially the harmonic mean of precision and recall, right? For good reasons. And so if you're doing it for F measure, that means because you're separating precision and recall, and you have, you know, FK measure can actually give K times more weight to precision than to recall, for example. Okay, so that's how you evaluate classification techniques. Okay? So coming from clustering, classification, so now we're going to look at some techniques. You know, we'll look at a couple of techniques today's class. Coming from clustering, the first obvious technique is I have clusters now. I know this cluster is class 1, this is class 2, okay? Somehow I should be able to use this information, Okay, so the simplest idea is essentially, if I give you if I give you D19, I can essentially somehow do some distance calculations between D19 and these guys, D19 and these guys. So if you are still in the middle of clustering, and D19 still has to pick its home, right? It can pick it. I mean, if it's K-means algorithm, by now this guy has a centroid, this guy has a centroid, this guy, you know, D19 decides which centroid they are closest to and joins that group. That's what you would have done during K-means. It's as if, you know, K-means never ended. You know, you essentially, every time you have a test data coming, you still get to make them join the clusters. Okay? So you basically first look at distance-based methods. They're very simple methods. Yeah?
But I shouldn't change the centroid by adding new data, because that adds bias.
Well, I mean, let's not talk about bias right now yet. In fact, the bias could also have been added from just the data itself. I mean, your point is well taken, but it's not, I could have given data that is very skewed as training data. Right? Bias is a much bigger issue. Again, look, the problem with this course is we'll kind of get into different topics, you know, and each topic is a semester-long or multi-semester-long courses. You know, machine learning, you know, can be obviously taken as a whole course separately. So I probably won't even talk much about bias here. Okay, but in general, I would not take a stance on that right now. Okay, so imagine these clusters, they have centroids, and then when this guy becomes part of this, when this guy needs to be classified, you assume that, you know, you actually compare this to its centroid versus this centroid and put it in the cluster where it belongs. Now the point that Jadiel is making is, in normal K-means, after D19 becomes part of this, you would have recomputed this centroid. Let's not do it, is what he's saying. Okay? Because somehow these labels you believe more than the labels you have done. Okay? Yes?
Is that how we classify the training data?
What? So the red is training data. The red is the training data. And the blues are coming one after other. D35, D47, they will be coming and you need to put them into the correct cluster. Okay? So it's basically a distance-based analysis can be done. And this idea that I just mentioned, which you would have probably thought about in 3 seconds, which is, you know, take the centroid. The first guy who apparently wrote about it for text data is Rocchio, and so it's called Rocchio classification. Okay, so you essentially assume, so if the training data is documents and in vector form, then you compute the centroid of these vectors, and then when a new document comes, you do, assume again, TF-IDF representation for the vector, and the new data comes, you do cosine theta similarity between the new document and these two centroids, and whichever it is closest to, you put it in that. Okay? That is a very, very simple idea. That's called Rocchio classification. Okay. The second idea, which we will talk about too. Okay. What did I do here? I'll come back to this in a minute. The second idea we talk about too is, now this Rocchio text classification, I'll show you that you can actually use that also more actively for retrieval itself, rather than wait for a document to be presented before you say it's relevant. You want to actually directly use your knowledge about relevant and irrelevant documents to rewrite the query and send it to the corpus so that all the relevant documents get retrieved in one fell swoop. Okay, same idea but being used to actively bring out the relevant documents rather than passively, you know, classify the presented documents. Okay? And then a different version for distance measures is not to think of the centroids, but think of neighbors. So if I'm sort of, let's say, here, then I can think of which points am I closest to. Okay, let's say, think about this. Here, suppose my D19 is here, sort of closest to this. The closest document to it is this. And so, since my friend seems to be in this cluster, I will join that cluster. So here you are comparing not to the centroid, but to the actual elements. And these are called the nearest neighbor methods. If you only look for one friend, it's one nearest neighbor method. If you look for k friends, and look for, so you take k closest friends, okay, and then look at their majority label. That means after k friends that are closest to you, you know, majority of them belong to which class? That's the class that you want to go to. That's also a distance-based method. It's sort of KNN versus centroidal method is sort of like analogous to centroid-based distances in clustering versus single link, complete link clustering. Right? Okay. So those are the two methods we'll talk about. But I just skipped over this, but these are all, you know, some of the applications for the classification, mail, spam mail detection, checking whether an article is from Wall Street Journal or New York Times, you know, being able to classify that, classifying whether or not something is relevant to the user so that you can recommend it to them, classifying, for example, whether a page is likely to send you to other pages of interest to you. This is important, by the way, in topic-specific crawling. I mentioned this when we were talking about if you don't have a full crawl for the entire web, and you only want the crawl for, let's say, a specific topic, so computer science, then doing the entire web crawl and then removing non-computer science seems like an unnecessary waste of time. Instead, what you want to do is somehow only crawl computer science pages, or at least try not to crawl non-computer science pages. Now, having crawled a page, then classifying it is useless because you actually got it already. So the question then would be, I'm on this page, it has links, is it worth following those links? So you want to be able to classify this page as a page that will eventually lead to good CS links or not. That way you can avoid, if it doesn't have good properties, that means it's not likely to have links to CS according to your classification, then you would just not generate its children, because of which you don't generate their children. And so a huge subtree can be avoided in the classification, in the crawling, okay? And then similarly, of course, recommendation systems, okay? And so in the case of, and we already talked about these examples, classification, classification examples, the simplest case, as I said, is Rakhio categorization, where you represent each document as a vector in using TF-IDF weighting, just like you did. Training would basically be, you know, take all the class vectors of one class, compute their centroid. Take all the vectors of the second class, compute their centroid. That's it. You're done. Now you have two centroids in your hand. During classification, given a new document vector D, you classify it into the class whose centroid it is closest to in terms of cosine theta metric. Okay? Now, if I want to convert this into an active method, that means I want not to wait for documents to be presented so that I will say it is relevant or irrelevant, but rather just compute, get all the relevant documents. Okay, then, so given a set of relevant and irrelevant documents, rather than classify a given document as relevant or irrelevant, we want to retrieve more relevant documents. Okay, that's what relevance feedback is. Okay, and the idea in relevant feedback is modify the existing, so if I give you a query, then basically the user gave a query, so you would then rank answers for that respect to that query and show, let's say, top 10 or top 100, and then the user basically clicks some of them saying, I like these, I don't like these. So among these 100 results, the user has given you which are relevant for them, which are irrelevant for them. Now you can sort of reduce, you know, the, so for example, if they said Bush, again, my favorite example, and the top 10 had some results from Kalahari Bushman and some results from George Bush, and the user clicked the Kalahari Bushman and said relevant, and George Bush and said irrelevant, now you suddenly have more information as to what the user is really looking for. So the next page, you can get better results. Now you can argue that what world are you living in? I never even go to the next page. You know, I mean, in search engines, you know, you just look at the top result and move on. Okay, again, relevance feedback is an IR technique. And it sort of used to believe that users would want to see all the relevant results eventually. And so they would continue in interacting with the system this way. And so if you can, let's see, this part will tell you a minute. So the two approaches are users select the relevant documents either directly or indirectly. Okay, directly means they'll actually click and say this is relevant. Indirectly means they actually look at that part more, those results more. I mean, there are techniques. You know, one of the biggest issues in labeling data is getting people to do labeling without feeling the burden of labeling. Do you see what I'm saying? So if you have to pay people to do this, if you ask them to, you know, here are 10,000 mails, can you please tell me which are spam, which are not spam for you, they're not likely to do it. So somehow the labeling should be easy for the user so that they're likely to do it. Okay, and so one idea would be indirect labeling. So you can have eye tracking studies, you know, where basically you actually looking at which part of the results the users are looking at more. And then the ones that look at more probably are the ones that are more relevant for them. So it's an indirect labeling. Notice if you do labeling that way, the training data labels are likely to be noisy. They could actually be wrong. That's a big issue in learning. You know, sometimes I will give you a homework problem and I give a solution, I may be wrong. And you know, in the final exam, if a problem comes, then you can always complain, saying, you know, you gave the same kind of solution, I gave the same kind of solution, why are you yelling at me? But especially if in fact you're being tested by somebody else other than me, right? They would not care that I gave you the wrong information. They care that you know the wrong information. Okay, and so a good learner also has to be able to handle the noise in the training data. Noise meaning some of the training data's labels are actually wrong. Okay, and that could happen especially when, you know, when you're computing the labels in this indirect way. The other idea for relevance feedback is essentially do the pseudo relevance feedback. So you first send the query, to your corpus, get top 100 results, then just assume that everything in the top 100 is relevant, everything else is irrelevant. Why? Because you felt so. Okay, looks like obviously a circular reasoning. It's not going to be anywhere near as good as actually depending upon direct or indirect feedback, but you know, this way you don't need to depend upon the users anymore. Okay, in the pseudo relevance, assume that the top K documents are the most relevant documents and everything else is irrelevant. And then either which way, you now know some relevant documents, some irrelevant documents. And then you can do this technique I'm going to tell you, which is rewrite the query. Okay, so now, so to understand how to rewrite the query, think about the following thing. Suppose the user actually gave you the query queue, but also painstakingly went through the 8 billion documents, you know, clicking all the documents they know for sure are relevant for them, and saying they are relevant, and the rest all are irrelevant completely. Okay? In which case, I know the set of documents that are relevant, I know the set of documents that are not relevant. Full set of documents that are not relevant. Now, what should be, if I now have to run this query, should I be doing? Should I even care about what original query you gave, or should I care about, you know, just what you actually showed me as to what is relevant and irrelevant to you? Obviously, in this case, you already shown me that these are truly relevant to you, these are all irrelevant to you. The query is supposed to help me figure this out, but now you told me these. So if I were to recompute your query, somehow I should find documents which are closer to the centroid of this whole set and farther from the centroid of this whole set. Right? So my new query, the optimal query in this case, would just be the centroid of the relevant set minus the centroid of the irrelevant set. The original query just goes out the window because it's useless now. Do you understand that? I mean, because once I show you exactly what is relevant and irrelevant to me, then the original query has no space, no place to play anymore. Okay. Now, obviously, this is an unrealistic scenario. Nobody is going to go through the entire corpus and tell you. Okay, so what will really happen is I took a small set of documents and showed some of them to be relevant, some of them to be irrelevant. So I would still like to take the centroid of these and be close to them, and the centroid of these I want to be far away from them. So I have, you know, centroid of this minus centroid of this. The only question is, do I care about the original query? Now, since the set is not the full corpus, obviously I don't want to completely kill my original query. So all I'm going to do is I'm going to change the query in a weighted fashion. The nice thing about it is all of these are vectors. So I compute the new vector to be alpha times the original query plus beta times this minus gamma times this. Okay, where in essence, as long as alpha is not equal to zero, you are giving evidence, a weightage to the original query. And you're just slowly shifting it towards the relevant and away from the irrelevant examples you are seeing. And this idea is called relevance feedback using Rockio classification. Okay? And then the interesting question, of course, is if I play with beta and gamma, what am I affecting? Yeah, in terms of precision and recall, what am I affecting if I play with beta and gamma? What precision, what recall? So if I play with beta, I'm essentially changing the precision. If I play with gamma, I'm changing the recall. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's not true. Because precision is about not getting the bad guys in. Recall is about getting all the good guys in. Remember it that way. Right? Precision is about not getting the bad guys in. That's all. That's why the best way, remember, the way to get precision is not to speak at all. Don't return anything. Then you'll have very high precision. Right? So you play with gamma, you're going to change the precision. You play with beta, you change the recall. Okay? So that's what that answer is. Okay? So that's your relevance feedback method in this case. And this is actually a worked out example with two relevant documents, two irrelevant documents, and alpha is 1, beta is 0.75, gamma is 0.25, and so it computes a new document, a new query vector. And you then run this query vector. So you have to rerun. Now it's like each query is now two queries. So you run it first on the document set, document corpus, and then get the labels on them, either using pseudo relevance feedback or using direct or indirect relevance feedback. And then you rewrite the query. This idea, by the way, relevance feedback rewrites queries. So query rewriting. It's a very interesting concept. We will talk about this again later. And in some sense, you have talked about query rewriting before too. So if you add, for a given query, if you add more terms, saying, you know, these are additional terms that I want to add, you're rewriting a query. Okay? And so relevance feedback rewrites the query such that the rewritten query is likely to have higher precision and recall than the original query. Okay? There was some question, somebody. Yes. No, these are basically set. Most people just set them. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could try to learn them by actual experimentation, but, you know, at the time Rockio classification technique came, they were just assumed that they will set them.
And rewriting the query is basically
changing
the...
This. So just adding alpha times original query plus beta times the centroid of the relevant document minus gamma times the centroid of the irrelevant document.
How do you get the irrelevant documents?
The ones that the user didn't look at are the irrelevant ones. That's the assumption. Yeah.
The pseudo relevance thing. Basically saying that you have a set of 100 documents which are similar to a query, and then you want another set of, say, 1,000 documents which are similar to these 100 queries.
Hmm.
It's like saying these 1,000 documents are similar to the query directly. Like,
yeah, so the obviously pseudo relevance almost makes no sense. But you know, the next thing I will tell you is that relevance feedback has been used in track-like scenarios. okay, where TREC, remember, is the IR community's test bed, where they would carefully set up queries and set up for with respect to each query, they will classify all the documents into relevant and irrelevant. And that's the golden standard. And then they'll give the query to your IR system. You come up with relevance, irrelevant documents. They will compare your classification to their classification. And if you are exactly their classification, you get full points. If not, you'll have either low precision or low recall. And you would compute the measure. Okay. And even pseudo-relevance feedback has been shown to actually work well in track-like scenarios. Okay. Relevance feedback is kind of an interesting idea, but as I said, in search engines right now, the way they'll wind up doing this is user profiling rather than right away rewriting the query. You know, they won't rewrite the query if this time around. Over a period of time, they will catch more about the kind of documents you are looking at. And in essence, you know, internally change the query that's being submitted the first time around upfront. So for the Michael Jordan example, suppose if I say Michael Jordan, they might just say Michael Jordan, the dweeb guy. And then I will get the real Michael Jordan, which is the machine learning guy. And if you say Michael Jordan, they might just leave it, and then you will get the basketball guy. Yes?
Google actually added query rewriting recently. You scroll all the way to the bottom of the page.
Mm-hmm.
There's usually a set of additional suggested queries that are your query plus.
Yeah, that is basically, by the way, that thing is done. The easiest way to do that is correlation analysis, right? I mean, that's the easiest way to do those suggestions, query elaboration suggestions, is correlation analysis. But Google can do that even also at the time you're typing the query. The difference is the bottom one is correlation analysis on the document corpus, and while you are typing, it's direct analysis on the query logs. Because they, you know, they have very efficient data structures for, as you start typing, they will look at the part of the data structure you are in, and you're able to say what other words were there after this word in any of the queries. And if you spend a lot of time computing that structure, then during the querying, it will be able to suggest to you what additions were people putting. Okay? Yeah, okay, so the other part that we were talking about, other distance-based method we were talking about was k-nearest neighbors. And that is the same idea, the same distance-based computation, except now you don't compute, you don't compare yourself to the centroids, but you compare yourself to the neighbors. Now, where do you think neighbor-based approaches might be better than centroid-based approaches? I mean, clearly, there is an approach here, okay? So in fact, one of the interesting things is when you have k nearest neighbors, so you need to first find k documents that are in the training data that are closest to you. K documents in the training data that are closest to you. And then look at their classes. And whatever is the majority class, that's going to be your class. So, yeah, just a second. So, to get the neighbors, in essence, you are retrieving. You are using retrieval techniques. To decide what are your k nearest neighbors, you are essentially using retrieval techniques just on the training data. Right? If your training data is the only corpus and I ask for top k documents for this query, then I would get the k closest documents. So, the way you compute this is using inverted indices on the training data and do actual ranking. That's the fastest way to do it. Okay, now as to why k nearest neighbors might be better or worse than this method, in fact, is connected to the question of the shapes of the clusters. Well, and the tightness and the shapes, right? So basically, here the assumption is these are spherical clusters separated in the distance space. If that's not the case, then what are you going to do? So what if in the Euclidean space, so here I just wrote the documents, but you know, if I wrote these documents in the Euclidean space, right? If those are the two original groups, it's reasonably obvious that, you know, the centroid for this will be here, the centroid for this will be here, and then a new guy coming in, let's say a new document, which is sort of this document here, you can realize that it's closer to this than that. And so you will give it this label. Right? Easy enough. Okay. But what if that's not the case? What if, in fact, you have more like this? Okay. That's possible too. Right? In this case, in essence, I have, actually centroidal distance would be completely misleading you, because in this case I made it in such a way that approximately the centroid of both would be the same. Right? So that's where you realize that essentially the neighbors matter more than the centroid. You see what I'm saying? So in this case, if you do k nearest neighbor, so suppose I give you a document like here, it would be close to both the centroid of the black ones and the red ones. I can make it such a way that it's actually closer to the black one than to the red one. And so it'll actually even misclassify it. Right? But what you really would like to say is, I guess intuitively, that this is the red one is the class, red is the class. And to be able to do that, if you compute its three nearest neighbors, let's say 1, 2, 3. Those are the three nearest neighbors. Maybe suppose that's the case. Okay? Then I will say, well, of which majority of them are red. Okay? So nearest neighbor approach essentially will have the, will be able to deal with non-spherical clusters. It can also deal with chain clusters. It can also deal with clusters which are within each other and so on. Better than the centroid based idea. Okay? Question on that. Until now, it's like if learning is this, then it's very good, right? Because you didn't have to learn any new concept. You know your vector similarity, you know your TF-IDF, you're just using it. Okay? So the next thing that we would ask about is, so why can't we be done here? In which case the class will be over and we'll say text categorization is over. These are reasonable techniques, it turns out. But there are problems with this, more so for the centroid one than for the k nearest neighbor, but all of them, both of them have these problems. Yes?
This is something different.
I did not say anything about LSI right now. I mean, you could use LSI, that's a different story. In fact, there is a whole issue of if you were to do LSI in the class, in the case of classification, how should it be done? You know, that's the point that I was talking about previously. The right thing to do if you're doing LSI, suppose I have this kind of a scenario where that is the black class and here is the blue class. Okay. Now if I do LSI, you know, approximately I'll get that and that as the axis, which should be the primary axis really. It should not be this, because this is useless. What you care about is not variance across data, but variance in the class. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that idea is actually called LDA. Now, in fact, these days there's a new LDA in town, but this LDA is linear discriminant analysis. So linear discriminant analysis is a generalization of LSI to classification problem. Or you can think of LSI as LDA, where each document is its own class. If each document is its own class, which is what you have when you don't know anything about the data, then the data variance is the same as class variance. So LSI makes the assumption that, you know, there is no class information. All data, each of you are unique. You are in your own class. Okay? And that's when you do LSI. Okay, but I didn't basically, that's an whole entire issue, and you can do LDA or LSI or dimensionality reduction or feature selection in classification tasks too. We'll talk about it a little bit next time. But right now I'm assuming it's just, this is my space. Whatever you did, this is your final space. In that case, you know, you would have been in trouble. Okay? So, you know, the problems with clustering-based methods, distance-based methods, is eventually they are not going to be able to deal well with the non-isotropic clusters. That means clusters which are not spherical and directionless. So isotropic means spherical and directionless. Okay, CS obviously we don't have directions. Okay, non-isotropic means chain-based classes. The class, if you put it in this place, will look like a big chain. Okay, that means some directions it has more variance than other directions. Okay, and it could be disjoint. In fact, one of the problems about clusters are, for example, coastal cities is a class in the US, right? I'm trying to give you the concept of coastal cities. Give me a reasonable distance measure where New York and Los Angeles are close to each other. And somehow the middle of the country is not in that class. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So now obviously the coastal cities is actually a kind of clusters where I would essentially have shown something more like this. Okay, here are all the reds, here are all the blacks. Okay, and then everything in the middle is green. So those are the non-coastal cities. This is US map, as you can see, right? The way you're looking, that's the New York side, that's the Los Angeles side. And this is the great unknown Midwest, right? And the question then is, if I give you some new place, is it coastal or not coastal? Right? If you do centroid-based, you're dead. Right? Because everything has the same centroid, in fact. Neighborhood-based is slightly better. Okay? But actually, to actually talk about why k nearest neighbor is not a good approach, I need to get into the notion of bias versus variance, which I don't want to get into right now. K nearest neighbors tend to overfit to the data. Okay, but we won't talk about that right now. At least understand that this idea that clusters are spherical and somebody has already looked at them and shown you them, and they're all nicely going to be close by in some Euclidean space, and so you can use distance-based techniques, is not really going to cut most of the time. Okay, you can have disjunctive clusters here like this, disconnected clusters. Okay, so coastal cities of class USA are, for example, Hawaii and Alaska are in USA class. Remember that. Okay, I mean, Hawaii is close to Japan. That's why Japan wanted it. I mean, they did K-means clustering and they thought that's there. And and then we started Second World War for no good reason, right? So the point is that essentially classes don't have to correspond to spherical clusters. And so distance-based methods are not going to be particularly good, right? Now, this should make you wonder, well, is it really the case that if you don't have classification techniques, then somehow clusters become spherical? No. Even when I just ask you to, if I show you some map and say cluster this map, without telling you anything about nations and so on. So you're a Martian, you came to this place and you're trying to somehow cluster them. Okay, the obvious, there is a reasonable cluster to be made which involves Hawaii as part of USA, because after all, there is a ground reality like that in political clustering. But most of the Martians won't find that political clustering. Okay, instead they would find the spherical clusters. Okay, and we don't necessarily make fun of them, because we assume that since they don't know anything, the best they could do is find spherical clusters. Whereas you don't have that, once I already shown you the colors here, then you no longer have the excuse of saying, well, I just thought, you know, the cluster should be spherical, because I told you they're not in this case. Okay, so the point is expectations are lower, surprisingly, I mean not surprisingly, for clustering. And so you give it a pass, even if it actually keeps finding, you know, spherical clusters. There are good clustering techniques which tend to, for example, find non-spherical clusters. As we, for example, we talked about the fact that you can get chain-shaped clusters by using complete link, for example. No, single link, for example, right? So there are ways of looking for certain types of clusters in the clustering techniques too. But in general, most of the time, you get a pass for clustering, whereas you don't get a pass for classification because somebody has already given you the labeled data. Okay, so it's not that this problem doesn't exist in clustering, it's that, you know, you are doing bigger problems, so I'll give you a pass on the sphericality of your clusters. But here, I already did half of the work, and if you still can't do the rest, I'm going to be mad at you. Right? So that's the basic point. Okay? So basically what you, so in the remaining 5 minutes, I'll actually give you sort of an overview for what we'll be doing next class, you know, quickly. So here is a completely different kind of data, because that's what I'll use for my next example. This is not text data, but this is a bunch of training examples, okay? These correspond to somebody's habits of whether or not they will wait for a table at a restaurant. Okay, and the each restaurant going experience has the following attributes. Is there an alternative for the restaurant? Is there a bar in the restaurant? Is it a Friday? Are there any patrons? How costly is the restaurant? Is it raining outside? And what type of cuisine is it? And how much time am I supposed to wait? And in this case, this guy basically decided to wait. So imagine you're carrying your iPhone with Siri along, right? And it found that you have done in these various restaurants whether you waited or not waited. Okay? Now clearly, obviously, some cases where there is nobody in the restaurant, okay, and you still are supposed to wait for 10 minutes, you won't wait. Because you're wondering, you know, you don't like my face or something? Why do you want me to hang around when there's nobody and you still don't want me to see it? So there is some patterns in this. The question is, you're trying to find the pattern that explains when does this person wait for a table and when does this person not wait for a table. And if I learn it, then, you know, if I, the personal assistant, learn it, then I can tell next time around, yeah, there's no point. You're not going to wait for this restaurant. Let's keep moving. Right? As far away from any useful application as possible. Now, it's also a classification problem. And you have attributes and their values and the classes. The two classes are yes, this guy will wait, and no, this guy won't wait. If I want to learn the underlying pattern in this, the test data for this would be a new scenario where all these attributes have values and you're trying to predict whether this guy will wait in the wait for the table or not. Okay, this is just a generalization. I mean, this is similar to other things like fraud, credit card fraud, and so on. Okay, so what it turns out is that you can try to learn patterns. There are patterns here, and you're trying to learn them. So, for example, I just learned a fast pattern that pretty much I think this is true in all these examples, that whenever there is nobody in the restaurant and there is a non-trivial waiting time, I won't wait for the table. It's like below my dignity because they're trying to insult me, you know, saying, you know, there's nobody, we are losing money, still we won't seat you, okay? So I won't wait. So that's a pattern I found. So the question is, if I learn these patterns, then in fact I can look at the entire new example and just look at that pattern and say, because of that, the class is this. Okay? Now, if I learn these patterns, how do I express them? So I have some sort of internal representation in which I express these patterns, and when the new example comes, I check the example against these patterns, and if it satisfies them, I'll give it a class label. Now it turns out that there are a humongous number of internal representations that you can learn. Okay, you can learn them exactly like what I said. If patterns equal to full and day equal to Friday, then I am likely to wait with pretty high probability. Okay, or I can write it as a decision tree where are there any patterns? None. If there is none, I'm not going to wait. Okay? If there are only few patrons, then I will wait because eventually I'll get a table. If it's full, Then I want to decide, in this case, this is what I learned. If it's full, then I want to decide whether it is the cuisine of my type, or what is the estimate of weighting. And after the estimate, is there an alternate? After that, is there a bar? And based on that, I'll finally decide whether I'll sit in this restaurant or not. So the pattern I found was written as a set of association rules here, as a decision tree here. Okay. I can also write it as a Bayes network, which we'll talk about as to what it is later on. You can write it as neural networks, which is another kind of a structure. Okay, so you can write, basically you're looking for patterns in this data and writing it in some language. This language is your bias. You're looking for patterns that can be expressed in this versus in this versus in this versus in that. Suppose it turns out that there is no simple pattern in the data. Nothing simple test is not going to tell you whether you're going to weight or not weight. Then decision trees are not going to be good. Suppose it turns out that your decision to weight or not weight is some sort of a weighted combination of all those attributes. Then in decision tree, all the branches would be equal length, which is a kind of a useless decision tree. Okay? And this will, on the other hand, be better. So the question would be, what kind of data are you likely to have? Based on that, you will then focus on learning that kind of representation. And without giving too much away, next class when I come back, I'll say that we have this kind of a thing. So a spam mail is not spam because there's a magic word in it saying I am spam. Spam mail is spam because a whole bunch of things increase its spamness, a whole bunch of things reduce its spamness. The total spamness is above a threshold, so you throw it out. Okay, I'll stop here. Please help yourself with more stuff to eat, and then I'll see you next class. You have to come to my class. Come to my office. Yes, thank you.
In authority steps, we are displaying top n
results. You have a short question?
About the
oh, okay. I'll send you an email. I think okay. You can do it, and I mean I can probably wait until the project due date is over, and then I'll return it at that time. Okay. Yeah.
So we are displaying top n. So, but. Let's say for a particular query, we have just four of adjustments which are the result factors.
Mm-hmm.
So are we still supposed to show the top 10 of them?
You're talking about in the search. No, there sometimes you do. I didn't understand.
Let's say for the particular query, we have just four documents.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones which are linking to and which are being linked to are like numerous.
Mm-hmm.
So the set becomes like, let's say, 100.
Yeah, but some of them might still be relevant to the user because the reason they are linking to you might be because they will lead to other pages. Well, actually, then they would be part of this.
That's what I'm concerned. Like, then how will we, compare authorities in Hubs and PageRank, because PageRank which always gives the result set which is meant to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And this will give even the results which are not even there in the result set.
No, it possibly could have been there in the result set. You just took the top 100. If you took all the 10 million results.
I'm saying, let's say for the four documents.
Mm-hmm.
We have just four documents.
Yeah.
Which are okay. The result set for a particular query.
Yeah, let me just
and we have that. Like the bigger set is like 100. And then we get.
Yeah, take some. Good, huh?
Then we still show the top 10.
Yeah.
What are we actually trying to mean over here?
I don't know that. See, showing top 10 is probably not the issue. The question is, how many of them are important? You know, authorities hub should be able to realize that the ones which are not answers are probably not important in that case. I mean, I think you're making an interesting question, but I need more of a concrete example to be able to see the problem. Okay, send it to me. After walk with me. It might be easier to get out of it. Okay, sure. Please do. Can you take this back to the lab? Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, let me just change, clean this up. Okay. Yeah, you came just a little too late. Yeah. Yeah. Just 1 second, let me give her this. What's your name? Satish Kumar Purnachandran, is he there? Venkataraman Kupaswamy, okay, there you go. Anvashadhar, Venkata Chaitanya Achanta, Priti, there you go. And then Abhishek Kumar, you are, Anir, I know, that's fine. Ganesh Krishnamurti, and Apurva Nair, and Arjun Mukherjee, Bhaskar Rangaswamy, okay. And then Pratap Singh, that's it. Akshay Sumal, oh, Anit, okay, sure. Just try it somewhere. No, that's not true. I just saw it.
Yeah.
Okay, take it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Sure.
While it's recording.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. Good for you.
Good for you. Big matter to debate.
Good for you.
Thank you. So, this is the query. 4 A's.
Mm-hmm.
It has only 4 A's.
4 A's.
Four A's has only 4 results, 4 documents.
But the query is 4 A's.
Yeah.
A.
So it has only 4 results, 4 documents by TFIDL.
Uh-huh.
But when you create a matrix out of it, it's like 15 into 15 documents.
Mm-hmm.
Which are being made to end results. So when you are saying, like, let's say, let's top 10 results, I consider n to be equal to 10.
Mm-hmm.
Then,
yeah, but the point is, I don't, first of all, n is not necessarily 10, many a time Google does give you just couple of results, because
yeah,
those are the ones that they have.
Sure.
The second, and then, you know, there is no reason why authorities hubs cannot quickly check before returning the results, whether their similarity is above zero, which PageRank does too. And
sure.
Similarly, the fact that PageRank doesn't return any result which is similarity above zero, below zero, is not a big deal, because it also does return results whose similarity is very close to zero, but they have a high page rank. And so it's likely to give results which are important pages but are not relevant to your document.
Means like it's like
not relevant to your query.
It's like a business strategy which they are following, or
No. I'm not talking. First of all, I don't want to ask. I mean, you're trying to classify errors, you know, as to which error is better. That's different from technical issue. Of you seem to start by saying somehow authorities hub is doing something wrong. It's giving me documents that have zero similarity.
Yep.
That's what is bothering you.
Sure.
But PageRank will give you documents that have very close to zero similarity but have huge importance. Huge global importance.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And I would think that those are similar problems.
So if we see PageRank, then we can also classify authorities and hubs into the same thing. Like, if this is doing this thing, why can't authorities and hubs do the same thing?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, so you could also stop it from returning anything whose similarity is zero, for example. Then your problem won't be there.
So when we compare the top 10 results of this and this, this
mm-hmm.
will even authority and hubs can have also those pages which are actually have no similarity but have an authority.
Yeah,
hub.
Yeah.
And over here it will have similarity.
Similarity above zero, that's because it has this one little test.
Yeah.
That little test authority hubs can do too. Again, the bigger issue is not so much, it's not a program, it's a technique. And so the technique, there is nothing in authorities hub that would change if you were to say before returning the results, make sure that all of them have greater than zero similarity.
Are we meant to do that?
You can. I mean, no. I think if you are not getting, so if this is presumably with respect to your project,
yeah.
In which case you should do it. I mean, there is nothing wrong in it. I don't know. Again, there is no received wisdom here, right? I mean, I think it's a very reasonable thing.
You are not looking for a
particular
thing.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No, I'm not. So you can stop it from... I mean, I did not know that you were doing this with respect to the project. I thought this was just a general discussion. Presumably, you are having this problem in your project. In which case, just, you know, stop it from returning in the last minute, which is a very very reasonable thing to do.
Actually, I did with that matter only. Mm. Like, four documents, I shouldn't show all the documents which have authority help, but they don't have any system.
But I mean, but the point is, you need to decide who, I mean, you better be sure that everybody would agree with you that lack of query similarity to the document will completely kill it. So, for example, how do you deal with Netscape being a browser, for example?
When it doesn't say that it's a
exactly.
Problem.
I know, normally they will do the anchor text, but what if, you know, the anchor text was not properly seen? Yeah, so.
That's true, but
okay. But I mean, I think you can. I mean, people do make a big deal about zero similarity, and that can be done for authorities' hubs too. I haven't thought about it before. I don't think anybody wrote a paper on this because it's just a small trivial detail. But you know, don't think of these as like received wisdom. I mean, their techniques, they have some obvious differences in terms of the way they look at the link matrix, but everything else is actually incidental. So, for example, the entire authorities' hubs was always done at the result time, whereas PageRank was done before the result time. But the whole discussion in my class is to say that you don't need to do it that way. You could have done PageRank at the result time, or authorities hub at before result time. The issue is, I mean, they came as a package, but when I give you a package, it doesn't necessarily mean that you must take the entire package. You know, you can decide which parts do actually make sense together.
Sure.
So suppose the original authorities hub was written in Pascal. Must you then assume that you should keep on writing in Pascal, right? So that's the kind of a thing. Okay?
And bro, sir, actually I had just one more thing to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
It's not regarding this course itself, but it's a search engine issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's we are making this other class, we are trying to do a semi-structured search engine.
Each end?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Actually. So after this project, after this class also, I want to continue with that. And I have some certain issues regarding that. So can I like consult you regarding
no,
that?
But first of all, I mean, you know, if it is to the extent that's more relevant to that class,
no,
you
no,
should
no,
talk to each end,
it's
right?
It's regarding more of crawling.
Yeah, during the normal office hours, you can always come because, you know, you can ask any questions during the normal office hours. You
okay.
know,
even
in my, I would not make, of course. That's true. I mean, in normal office hours, pretty much anything. Unless somebody is waiting for more related questions, it's fine.
Okay. Thank you so much.